Welcome to Bee's Table Talk, the podcast in which we have great conversations about business and our economy. My name is Bee Kyle, President and CEO of the St. Paul Area Chamber, and I'm so glad that you've joined us. I always enjoy these. These conversations are my chance to get to know leaders among us, doing great things within the community and within their organizations. And this year, as you know, I'm excited to invite our dedicated partner and sponsor for this podcast, Wells Fargo. So Wells Fargo is a diversified and community-based financial services company with a legacy of extraordinary engagement in this region. We have been the beneficiaries of that. Their vision is to help consumers and small business owners succeed financially. And I'm so honored that they chose to support this enterprise and our programming as well. So more to come on that. My guest today is a new friend with a heart for and a career driven by service. Leah Hebert Wells is the CEO of Open Arms of Minnesota. And if you're not familiar with this organization, Open Arms is a nonprofit that prepares and delivers nourishing meals free of charge to critically ill Minnesotans and their loved ones. Quite a mission. I met Leah at their grand opening in late 2022, and I was so impressed both by her and this organization that I asked her if she'd be willing to join me for a conversation today. So thanks for being here today, Leah, and welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm really glad to be here.
So those of you, of course, this isn't seen by video, it's only audio, but I'm looking at Leah and she's wearing a hat today. So she is a spirit child of, you know, team culture. And so why don't you tell us about your hat today? And then really, we really want to get to know you. So let's start with, you know, where'd you go to school? What did you envision yourself doing at this age such that you were wearing a hat today?
It's funny. I'm wearing a hat today, first of all, because it is Volunteer Appreciation Week. And at Open Arms, we take that very seriously. And we have sort of a spirit week. And today is hat day. So yesterday was pajama day. And the day before that was 80s day. And I have entertained my staff both days. For sure.
Very nice.
I did not, you know, I guess, but when I started college, I definitely didn't imagine myself here for sure. But I think the most relevant piece of information about that is that I had a child when I was 17. And so my experience growing up and going to college, which I did at St. Cloud State, and then my career choices were really shaped by that experience. And I think that experience really drove me to want to, you know, change the world, do things differently, make the world a better place for people. I had to ask for help a lot when I was a single mom and a teenager and trying to go to college at the same time. And I had really good experiences asking for help, and I had really bad experiences asking for help. And so for me, it really drove my desire to work in nonprofits and make sure that when people ask for help, they get what they need and they're treated really well.
You're awfully young to have come to those conclusions. Those are hard life lessons to learn that young.
They were, but they were good because it just made me who I am today, honestly.
Yeah. Special. I'm a Benny, so we're cousins.
Yes.
Right. So I wanted to flag that for a bit. I saw that you were St. Cloud State girl. I'm like, oh, yeah. Cousins, very nice. And where did you go to high school?
I went to high school in Hastings. So I'm a Minnesota girl through and through.
And a river child as well.
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm. Love the river.
So a lifetime of service, and that's what is developed in your heart. So what did your career path then look like to get you to Open Arms of Minnesota that I hadn't even heard of before until your group was introduced to me like a couple of years ago?
Yeah. I started in domestic violence. So I've only worked in nonprofits my whole life. I'm 50 and I have had 20 plus years, obviously, of experience in nonprofits. And I started working at a battered women's shelter, doing direct service with women, writing restraining orders, working the overnight shift and doing all of that, and worked my way into administrative positions from there. And then really, I think the direct service was really important to shape my career path and give me some really good experiences directly helping people and working with folks and seeing the needs in the community from that perspective. And then I wanted to be able to make change within organizations and drive organizations. And so then I moved into administrative work and started as the fundraiser, and then moved into my very first executive director position was at a very small arts organization, and I was 27. So I was very young. And then I've been an executive director pretty much since then. So I have, I think I'm attracted to organizations that provide access to resources that people can't get or don't have access to. That's really my passion. So I've worked in a whole variety of organizations, but what led me to Open Arms, I knew the previous executive director, I knew the reputation of the organization. And when I saw the open position, I was really attracted to the community building piece and to the piece about helping folks in the community get access to food that they wouldn't otherwise have.
There's this interesting concept. I had a conversation. I talked to so many amazing people, and I talked to another amazing person earlier this week. And he talked about this idea of proximate leadership. I was this whole idea that leaders who arise from the communities and issues they serve in have that experience and understanding that are essential for developing solutions with measurable and sustainable impact. I just find that. So when I was talking to him about that, I mean, I see you as a proximate leader, someone who's intimately connected to the work you do. How does that resonate with you?
I mean, I love that concept. I love that concept. I think it's super important that you have actually served the community, lived in the community, understand the community, and listen to the community as a leader. I think that's critical, and involve the community in your work. I think that it's really important, though, when people come from the community, when you are a proximate leader, that you always have the ability to be introspective, because there have been times when I was too close to the community, I think, or too close to the issue where I wasn't able to make change. And so I think leaders who arise from the community in the way that you're describing always just have to continue to challenge yourself to also be able to know when you're too close to an issue, or to be able to see the issue from a big picture perspective. Does that make sense?
From where I'm sitting, it makes great sense. Yes, because I've run into that. I mean, it's something that I have to do. And I just think it's really wise counsel for any of us really wanting to do work that we get attached to, emotionally engaged with, ethically and values driven engaged with. That doesn't always mean this path is the right path versus that path. And how do you make thoughtful strategic decisions? So I appreciate that. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, with that in mind, some folks don't know who Open Arms of Minnesota is. So let's step back just a little bit, because you know I'd like to jump right into who is Leah. So let's back up and take a look at Open Arms of Minnesota. I was introduced to your organization probably, it might even have been pre-pandemic, when you started looking for a St. Paul location. And we were talking about potential sites. You wound up with a great location over on the west side, which is very cool. So tell us about the premise of the organization and then what you do in your St. Paul location. Well, where are your locations?
Yeah. I mean, the premise of the organization is really what you were just talking about, just really proximate to the community. The organization started with a volunteer, with somebody in the community during the AIDS epidemic in 1986, who looked around and saw that folks that he knew were isolated, living in their apartments or houses, and because they had AIDS, they were wasting away and nobody wanted to come into their homes and talk to them, touch them. People were afraid. And so he said, I'm going to cook meals for these people in my kitchen, and I'm going to find friends to deliver these meals to them. And at that time, we wanted those meals. They were, big calorie, cheesy, saucy meals that were really designed to help folks prevent people wasting away from their illness. And over the years, then it really evolved to a cadre of volunteers. We brought in more and more community members and really stayed in that HIV AIDS lane until about the early 2000s, providing meals to people who had HIV AIDS. And then in 2000s realized, wow, there is a lot of folks out there who have illnesses that can be helped by the right diet and the most appropriate food for them. So we expanded, and now we provide. So we have two kitchens, like you said, one in South Minneapolis, we've been in South Minneapolis since the beginning, and in this building since 2010. We have two kitchens. They're commercial kitchens, beautiful, huge kitchens, and we cook meals for people who have life-threatening illnesses. So we still cook meals for people who have AIDS or HIV. Or are HIV positive, but we've really expanded. Many, many of our clients have cancer, have cardiac issues, are having dialysis. And so food is just a critical piece of their healing journey or living with their illness. And so our folks cook meals, and we deliver meals to people in the community in the metro area. And we ship those meals to people who live in outstate Minnesota to the tune of about 1.5 million meals a year.
Wow. Okay. I mean, I'm pausing because you just let that sink in for a minute. So as you're listening to this now, wherever you're sitting right now, imagine this building. So Leah, I want you to paint the picture of the building.
Yeah.
So someone's walking in and there's an opportunity to 1.5 million. Did I get that right?
Yeah. About million and a half meals a year.
Give us a picture. You're walking in over in the Riverview Business Center, if you're St. Paul fluent. You're on the west side. You walk into this beautiful building. What do you see?
Well, both of our buildings are designed deliberately so that the first thing you see when you walk in is our kitchen, because the kitchen is really the heart of the organization. So we have these big commercial kitchens. We have hundreds of volunteers. I mean, that's our secret sauce, is that we build these amazing communities of volunteers. So we have hundreds of volunteers every day who come into both of our kitchens and help our staff cut vegetables and prepare and package meals for our neighbors all around us living with life-threatening illnesses. And our buildings intentionally are created to be a joyful community, even though we deal with very serious issues. We try and build this community of folks who are happy to be in our building. So there's music playing and there's tons of people in the kitchen, and we're doing trivia games sometimes with our volunteers, and there's a lot of activity, and we're getting ready to do a daily delivery to, over 100 clients a day, or maybe almost 200 clients a day now. And we're just getting ready for all of that. And it's usually a fun place to be, a warm place to be, and a place where you feel immediately like you make a difference, because you're packaging meals that literally go out almost immediately to our clients.
And what I found really sensitive on your part is this, the cultural sensitivity piece of it. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think lots of people can relate to that. If you don't like the food, if the food isn't familiar to you, you're not going to eat food. So if you want people to feel like you are meeting them where they're at, and you are creating food that's designed for them to help them deal with their specific illness, you need that food to be comfort food for folks. And I think sometimes we forget, we get very insular and forget that what's comfort food for us is not necessarily comfort food for everybody. So we just, a couple of years ago, we launched our cultural meals project, which has been a very deliberate program and project working with the community to design three specific menus: a Hmong menu, a Latinx menu, and an East African Somali based menu, with the community submitting recipes, with experts in the community helping us do that, and making sure that we have heart healthy, diabetic friendly menus that are culturally relevant to folks, so that they eat the food, it feels familiar to them, and it helps them heal and get better.
And I just find that so marvelous. You know, I'll tell you, some learning that I've undergone these last few years is this idea about, again, this word proximate is really captivating me. Mm-hmm. And I was meeting with a nonprofit this morning that does mentoring for youth. And he's in the community. He's in the Rondo area neighborhood. He's attached to a community center, and he's working with kids in the neighborhood. And this idea about organizations need to be connected to the community that serve, so that there's relationship that happens, that you see one another and it's intimate and real. And sometimes the bigger an organization gets, the further away from the ground you get, the less impactful, like, to human condition you are. It's just, I don't have good words for it yet, but when I apply that conversation and then that thinking, and then I talk to you, I see your joyful face. I mean, for those of you who don't know Leah, she's vibrant and she's alive and she brings joy with her into the room. However you see her, it's with a smile and a hug and an embrace, emotional and physical. And you do so really connected to your people, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, that's very nice of you. First of all, thank you for all of those compliments. That was very nice. I feel like, you know, I've had a lot of conversations about Open Arms growth and about growth in general and staying committed to the community and staying connected to the community, because when I started, we were much smaller. So 10 years ago, when I started, we were a $2 million organization serving 600 clients a week. And now we're an $11 million organization serving almost 2000 clients a week. And so we've undergone a lot of expansion. Now we're in two different locations, and some of the things that make it so special have always made Open Arms so special is that community connection, right? Is that we know the first name of the volunteer when they walk in the door.
Right.
That our clients decide, oh, I'm better and I want to come volunteer. And we know that. And so I think that is really hard. It is really hard to grow and retain those things. You have to do it really deliberately. You have to write job descriptions that reflect it. You have to talk about it. You have to put it in your strategic plans. You have to define what the culture is and all the ways you're going to keep it, you know, and definitely these are conversations we're having a lot and really critical because, you know, when you lose the connection to the community as an organization, especially as a nonprofit who, in my opinion, belongs to the community, that's who we belong to, then you've really lost what makes nonprofits relevant.
So, you know, being as respectful of privacy as possible, are you able to share one or two stories of clients? And I mean, you keep coming back for a reason. There's an emotional connection to the work you do. Give us some examples of moments that might feed you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of the moments, there's sort of both ends of the spectrum, right? There's the letter we got from of the partner of a client who took the time to write this whole description of the client's last couple hours of their life. And the fact that they ate, you know, he said, you know, my partner ate your cherry, I can't even remember which cookie it was. It had something to do with fruit, but ate that cookie, you know, an hour before he passed away, and he enjoyed that. And so being that, that's so humbling to me that we can be such a significant part of people's lives, that we might be we're making food that's the last thing they eat. And, you know, I had another client who was actually a board member as well, who passed away. And when I asked her before she passed away, I asked her what the most impactful things of, you know, of getting meals was for her and her partner. And she said, it was the fact that we could sit on the couch and hold hands and not have to go grocery shopping and make our meals and expend all my energy that way. We got to sit on the couch and we got to hold hands and we got time together. We got to break bread together. And that is beautiful. And I'll never forget that. And because she passed away shortly thereafter. But then there's also these amazing stories of, I've gained 20 pounds and you kept me out of the hospital. And without these meals, my blood sugar wouldn't be regulated. And I've been able to go off my medication. And those kinds of stories that we hear all the time that are just, I mean, those are amazing, the success stories. So on both ends of the spectrum, I think it's just really humbling and to be part of such a significant part of folks' lives when they're dealing with a critical illness that, I mean, it takes us down. We all know, we've all had somebody who's sick like that. We know what it's like it's terrifying and huge in your life. So to be part of that is really special.
Well, that would lead me to another question, which is, you know, so many of us, I'm feeling that story because my mom just passed away about a year ago. So there's at least one person listening who's dealing with or has dealt with critical illness in their family, and they don't know about you. You know, what advice do you have for them, and where do you fit in service to these families?
Gosh, my staff would say, oh, I know how Leah's going to answer this question, which is, we want to help every single person we can. So So, you know, it, we absolutely want, we do, we want to be available for people in the community who help, who need that kind of help. So, you know, if you have a life-threatening illness, if somebody in your family has a life-threatening illness, please do go on our website, get the find out how to get involved. There's paperwork on our website. You can figure it out right away and figure out how to become a client. If there's somebody like you or somebody like me, I lost my dad a couple of years ago as well. And I understood at a different level how food could be so significant. So if there's people like you and I who are looking for another way to give back, boy, this is a great way. Our kitchens always need volunteers. We always need delivery drivers. And it's just such an immediate way to give back and make a difference in somebody's life when you know what their family is going through, you know? And so I love delivering to clients, and I love delivering birthday cakes on their birthdays or,
how sweet is that?
It's so fun. It's the best thing. And for a lot of our clients, we're the only ones, you know, they're isolated. They are maybe elderly. They don't have a lot of resources. So to do it is really fun and it's really meaningful. So if people are looking for that, please do go to our website. It's openarmsmn.org.
Openarmsmn.org.
Yep.
All right. Gotcha. And so when you think about the world of service, and I think about folks who are my heroes because they have chosen professions like you that are devoted to the service of others. I also know that it can be draining work for the person. And you need to be very intentional, you know, as you said earlier, be strategic such that you don't lose yourself in the connection. But two, how do you recharge yourself? Like, what do you do to get balanced, feed your own self, recharge to come back at it?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't always very good at it because I think that's typical for lots of us, right? It was hard at different times in my life, especially when I was working in domestic violence. There were things that happened that made it really hard to remove yourself.
I think
you have to know when you're burned out. I could tell when I was burned out, and a burned out person in social service is not a good thing and is actually harmful sometimes to staff. So I think it's important to know when you're burned out and you need to step back. But I think that, and for me, it's my family. It's making sure that there's some kind of a balance. I mean, my job doesn't have a lot of work-life balance. I mean, many of our jobs don't. But for me, it's that when I do step back, I really live in the moments that I'm in, right? You know, I was going to leave today at 3:30 to go watch my son play baseball because he's a junior in high school and he only has another year left. And so it's like, if I don't take those opportunities, and then I'll work tonight at 10 o'clock, right? You know, if you don't take those opportunities, boy, you lose a lot. So I try and really, like, I go to my cabin and I travel and I try to be there for my kids and enjoy the moments in their lives before they get so old that they don't want me around.
You know, so let's just pause on that for a moment. Somebody, another smart person said to me last week, we live our life forward, but it only makes sense when we look backwards, right? And as a quilter, I always think of, you know, God makes this quilt of your life, because when you zoom in, it's just a jumble of mismatched pieces. And you wonder what in the world is going to be done with this. From you're 17 years old and you've got a little one and you're trying to figure out how to do life and care for this child. And then you zoom out 18 years later and you go, wow, you know, that wasn't that. Yes, challenging. And look at the amazingness that has come from something you had no idea about. So just the whole idea about over time, things create a pattern or end up being part of something really amazing that you could never imagine in that moment of crisis.
For sure. For sure. I mean, I think about that a lot too, because, you know, when I was so young and I never would have imagined what my life would be like fast forward. Like,
yes.
And, but when I look back and I really think about it, I would not have ended up where I am today had I not had that experience. And I wouldn't have seen the plan for me or the quilt, like you said. I wasn't able to see it at that time. But looking back, my experience is struggling and my experience is, you know, asking for help and needing help and struggling and trying to figure out all that stuff really shaped and now gives me the strength and the drive to help others. And so I totally agree with you. Like, I think that you have to look backwards in order to look forward. I think that's a really wise thing that your friend said.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, you know, very cool.
When I hear what you say about there's a blessing in struggle, because what a muscle that you practiced and exercised and got stronger as you, when you were much younger than most who ever, if ever, figured this out, is this idea about, I can't do it alone. This idea that I need help, and not attaching a negative value statement to that, or maybe you did and you got over it, but it's like, this journey can't be done. You can't get through life alone.
Yeah.
And if there's anything you could learn, is the grace in receiving and then ultimately the grace in giving that you figured out young. That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'll never forget. I went to go ask for, I was working full time at the Better Women Shelter. My daughter was like 4 or 5, and the humility in going, I didn't have any money for Christmas, and I had to use the same resource I was sending my clients to. I was sending my clients to a church that was giving away presents for Christmas, you know, so that for women who couldn't afford to buy their kids presents. And so, you know, you could go pick through a couple things and get 2 or 3 things for your kids. And I ended up having to use that same resource and go into the church and pick out a couple things, and thinking the whole time, gosh, I hope I don't see any of my clients here. I hope I don't see anybody I know here. And I'll never forget that in that experience, because it just taught me what it is like to have to ask for help, and and how hard and embarrassing, or just how hard it can be. And so I'm really glad I had those experiences now, to our previous question, because I think that it makes me so resolute. I tell my staff all the time, you know, people shouldn't have to prove that they need help. They should be able to ask help, and they shouldn't be made to feel bad about it. And I will not ever work in an organization that makes people feel bad about asking for help.
Boy, really impactful. Okay. And now, because I am, of course, an advocacy organization, I represent for-profit and nonprofit, I'm interested in this question of you, which has to do with policy.
Yeah.
Because one of the joys of getting to work in an organization like mine is we can choose the issues we advocate for, and we can take a holistic approach to business, which of course I believe not only there's this artificial separation, as if to say you're either in business or you're in community or you're nonprofit. And the truth is we're like integrated. I'm at home and then I go to work. I'm both. And I have issues that affect me as a human, and frankly, we're human first. So how can we be thoughtful as a business organization in our policy work to advance things that you care about? So my one question, and this one I gave you in prep because I wanted you to think about this one, which was, what would you say is at least one policy, state level, local level, that would positively impact your work? What might that be?
My example is not very sexy, but
policy rarely is. So
it rarely is, right. Honestly, right now, the biggest thing I would change is the coverage for food for folks. So right now,
you mean like WIC? I mean like
Medicaid and Medicare.
Medicaid, okay.
So right now, health insurance rarely covers meals for people, and even SNAP only covers ingredients, not meals, right? So there's if you are on Medicare or Medicaid or private insurance, or you get SNAP dollars or WIC dollars, none of the very, very, very rarely do they cover prepared meals. And so that would be something that I would right now in particular really change, because that would immediately make it possible for so many people who have a need for, you know, for food and meals because they can't make their own meals to have access to it. And you know, regardless of age, income, all of that. And we are just struggling right now. I'm sure you know, you're hearing this too with food in general. There's so many more folks who are food insecure, working folks who are struggling to feed their kids, people who have full-time jobs, people who can't work, all a whole variety of people are struggling right now. Food shelf use is up higher than it has been. It continues to be up at pandemic levels. We're just really struggling as a community. And then on top of that, so many more folks have heart disease, are, you know, dealing with diabetes. We just also have those issues. Of course, you're going to hear this siren, the weather siren in the background. I'm so sorry.
Oh, it's all good.
It's because we scheduled, I don't know, I guess it's just, I was going to say the first Wednesday, but it's not. So I just think that if we as a society could find a way to feed people, especially feed people who are sick, we would be able to prevent an enormous amount of illnesses and costs down the road, right? So we're paying for things down the road that could be prevented with healthy meals and with healthy food and the right kind of meals. So that's my non-sexy example, but that's what's
top of mind. That's a great one. Really, yeah. Really. And the transformational stuff, that's the beauty of it though. That's achievable.
Yeah.
It's not, you're saying, well, B, if the water were green or if the water were red, I'd be good. That would solve my problem. Well, I can't help you with that, but this is the kind of thing that you actually can make a difference on.
Yeah.
So, all right. So one final question for you, and it has to do with why the chamber, like I know why I love you and what you're doing. What is the value to you to be engaged in an organization like a Chamber of Commerce?
I mean, I think the mistake is that people feel like we're so separate, right? That for-profit and nonprofit are so separate and so different and never shall the two meet or whatever. The reality is that my organization absolutely cannot survive without businesses and without other organizations like the chamber and membership organizations, businesses, foundations, corporations. That's what keeps Open Arms going. And so we just, and people, right? The people who work in all of these different places. And so really relationships and community building is at the heart of what we do. And so we love our relationships with business and corporations. We bring in so many volunteers that way. We form partnerships that way. We, you know, do policy together. We educate people that way. And we honestly, I can't imagine not having just a big, you know, relationship between the for-profit world and the nonprofit world. We just have to keep doing it. We can share best practices. Like I learned from my peers who are in the for-profit world. And a lot of us, like at Open Arms anyway, I have a for-profit model as part of, you know, that some people would consider a for-profit model. I have healthcare contracts and I have contracts where other organizations and businesses are buying meals for their patients and their clients. And so I learned so much from talking to my peers in the for-profit world, things that I can really use to make Open Arms better and to help serve more people.
I appreciate that. That's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the clock and unfortunately we've run out of time. Yeah. I just wanted to thank you again. I have loved visiting with you. I appreciate your time. I appreciate what you do to serve the community. I appreciate how you operate as a proximate leader in serving the most vulnerable among us. So thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. It was so much fun.
Yeah. This is kind of fun, isn't it?
It is fun. I love it.
Good. Good. Well, and thank you to our listeners as well for joining us for Bee's Table Talk. And also to Wells Fargo. We too are supported by organizations who believe in what we're doing. And so Wells Fargo is our partner, our sponsor, our friends. We have more conversations ahead. I've got some fun leaders that I have scheduled for the year, all within the greater MSP, some coming into the greater MSP. Stay tuned for that. And you can hear from them on how their companies are investing in tomorrow. So thanks to all of you, and we'll see you in the trenches.